Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. And Tinsley's going to come up and introduce our speaker tonight.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Are you nervous about what I'm going to say about you? Well, you should be. You know, I've known Julie a long time, and we're real good friends, but it didn't start off that way. I don't think we liked each other in the beginning. We used to go to the 9:30 meeting. I remember sitting there at a table in the meeting, and I had one of my AA slogan shirts on, and I said, wearing it proud. It looks pretty good, I think. And she said, did you have that shirt special made for you? And I said, no, I didn't. I got it off the Internet. And she said, I'm so relieved. And, and then a few weeks later, she told me to stop giving her sponsee rides to meetings. So that's another story. But anyway, I kind of thought maybe, she might be a bitch or something. But then I decided that she wasn't. And I decided that she was nothing more than a teller of unpopular truths. And which is another way of saying it, I guess. But I'm sure she's going to have some unpopular truths to tell. But she's also going to tell how she managed to stay sober, clean and sober, for almost 20 years and had a good time doing it. So I'm not going to tell you how she did it. She's going to tell you. And let's welcome Julie.
I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. Tinsley failed to tell you that the shirt he was wearing said, I'm the chairman. And he was the chairman of the group at the time. I thought, oh, I really hope he didn't have that made special. But my home group is the 9:30 on the other side of that wall. And I do like to start my story by telling you what I call the statistics so that you don't spend the rest of the time trying to figure out all the details that I try to figure out when somebody's telling their story, which is how old I am and how long I drank and all that kind of stuff. So I will just give them all to you up front. I was born on May 23rd, 1961, which makes me 52 years old. I had my first drink in the fall of 1979 when I was 18 years old, and it was legal in Florida at the time. I had my last drink on February 25th, 1995, so I have 18 years of sobriety and some change. And that made me 33 years old when I stopped drinking. I do have to tell you guys, ironically, that there are no drugs in my story, okay? No drugs at all. And you could not have told me 18 years ago that I would stand up here and apologize to you for that. But apparently that makes me unique now in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there are reasons for that, but I have never done any drugs. I have never had a single, toke from a joint. Is that right, Tinsley?
Yeah.
Tinsley, help me out. Okay. Go to my go-to drug addict in the room. Anyway, if you're sitting in this room, you're probably in some stage of alcoholism. You may be in the throes of active alcoholism, where you had your last drink before you came here, or in the parking lot, or maybe you're sitting there thinking, I hope she shuts up so I can get home and have another drink. And that's okay, because I'm glad you're here. We're all in a different phase of our alcoholism, and that's why we're in this room. You may also be in that recovering state, the process of recovering from alcoholism, from the process of staying sober. And that's really a joyful place when you get to put your head on the pillow at night knowing you didn't drink all day, and that you did the best you could with what you had, and you just felt really good about it, and then a little later you put your head on the pillow and you realize, I didn't even think about drinking today, and it just goes on and on with itself, and it's really a great place. Or you could be where I am in my alcoholism, which is recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, trudging the road of happy destiny as long as I maintain it, my spiritual condition, on a daily basis. And that's what I've been doing for a few 24 hours. There's a description of what it feels like to be recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body in the Big Book. And it's on page, starts on page 84, and I want to read it for you because this is true for me. And this paragraph describes the only reason that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. It goes like this. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. That's a pretty darn good promise in the book, and I can tell you that it has come true for me. I'm going to tell you a little quick story to kind of prove that, and when I realized for myself that indeed I had reached that stage. A couple of years ago, my husband asked for a very specific thing for Christmas. I should probably qualify, my husband is not one of us, and he's the kind of person that at 9:30 on a Friday night will announce that he's going to the corner. That means he's going to the gas station to buy one beer and bring it back home and drink it. And I look at him and say, that's a waste of gas. But that's how he drinks. Okay, so two years ago, he asked for something very specific. He asked for a home brew kit. And I chuckle at this because, you know, I know this paragraph is true for me because my first reaction was not, you know, oh my God, a home brew kit. I can't live in the same house with a home brew kit. I'll drink it. I know I will. You know, it wasn't that. And my first reaction was not, you know, you son of a bitch, can't you see I'm recovering from alcoholism? You know, wasn't that. My first reaction was, oh great, we're going to get ants. Okay, so I can tell you that alcohol has ceased to be a problem for me. I don't, you know, it didn't even dawn on me that there was alcohol in it, you know. And but there are some things I probably could do a little more spiritual work on. Like my fear of ants and things like that. But so how is it possible, you know, to be one of us and then get to that state where, you know, it doesn't bother you really at all? I'm going to do the best I can to explain to you how I did that, or how the program of Alcoholics Anonymous did that for me. Like I said, I had my first drink in the fall of 1979 at the University of Florida. Please don't be a hater. Just try to listen to the rest of it as best you can. But before that, you know, I was actually, I mean, before, right, like the moment before I had my first drink, I was morally against alcohol. I'd seen what it did to my family. My parents were both alcoholics. My mother eventually died of this disease, which is an extraordinarily hideous way to die. And I just had a real moral feeling that, you know, you shouldn't drink and it was really bad and all those things. But my girlfriend showed up in the dorm with the vodka and the orange juice and fixed one, and I was 18 and it was legal, so I thought, well, what's the big excitement about? And I drank it, and like you hear in this room over and over again, I remember every second of that. I remember how it felt. I remember what happened, and it was a miraculous feeling of being free for the first time, of no longer being so incredibly uptight. It was like my skin fit. It was like I just arrived. It was a gorgeous feeling. And, you know, it's amazing because from that moment on, I was no longer morally opposed to alcohol. Not in the least. But I would chase that feeling of finally feeling like I fit in my skin for 15 years until I found it again in Alcoholics Anonymous. My drinking progressed through college, you know, those, you know, yeehaw college days of drinking where everybody's doing it and some of us get more drunk than others, but nobody really is taking score or keeping score on that kind of thing. It progressed through that to happy hour drinking after I got my little corporate job, and we'd go out and go to happy hour. in the bars, and this was in Tampa, and it was really quite a lot of fun, and it was like all the young singles hanging out in the bars in downtown Tampa, and that was when drinking meant what it says in the big book about drinking. It says that it means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination, release from care, boredom, and worry, joyous intimacy with friends and feeling that life is good, the goose hung high, as Bill Wilson liked to say. And that's the way it felt. And it was a lot of fun. I'm not going to lie to you. But it was soon, and I mean really soon, that I began to feel really horrible about myself, my behavior, and this thing that had me, you know, just had me. And I couldn't stop it, and I was terribly unhappy. But I did what we all do. I told myself I was happy and all those kinds of things. But I was beginning, I was doing and saying things that I couldn't undo. You know, dangerous, tragic things, like, you know, falling down an entire flight of uncarpeted wooden stairs in a bar. You know, which hurts even drunk, by the way. It's not like the movies or anything. When you fall down the wooden stairs, it definitely hurts. And I don't care how drunk you are, but, you know, I could have killed myself doing that. Of course, I drove drunk. I woke up with strangers. I, you know, stalled out my career, just stalled it. I have to kind of tell you, I was kind of on the fast track, but it slowed way down. After, you know, you get drunk with the executives too many times and they kind of pat you on the head and say, go back to your corner, you know. Eventually, it became drinking alone in my apartment all the time, all night, every night, trying to keep some degree of normalcy, but really drinking to blackout basically every single night. You know, I used to, I remember I would watch Seinfeld, the original episodes, not the repeats, and I would write down what it was about because I knew the people at work the next day would be talking about what happened to Seinfeld, you know, in Seinfeld. And I mean, it's just so pathetic because that show is about nothing, and I had to write down nothing to remember nothing, you know? I mean, it was ridiculous. But I did. I just drank myself into incomprehensible, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And, you know, I really don't think I need to describe that anymore. I think the people in this, if you're in this room, you understand what that means. And, you were probably there in some form with me in spirit. But by the time I got here, I was drinking to blackout every night. I was basically going to work, driving to Green's liquor store, going home, drinking, passing out, getting up, going to work, doing the same thing. But there was something that happened in the middle of all that was a bit of a miracle. Of all that ugh, going on in my life, there was a bit of a miracle. And that was that I found a man who didn't leave, didn't walk away from that. And I don't know what that was about. I still don't get that. You'd have to ask him. It sounds like a personal problem to me, but he didn't leave, and he did something even more remarkable and inexplicable. He actually married me at my bottom, so that must have been fun. But he did. So in the middle of all this, I'm at my bottom. I'm a newlywed. I have a job. I have a car. You know, we're building a house. I have the stuff, but I am emotionally and spiritually as dead as you could possibly get. You know, I just couldn't deal with the stuff that was going on. I mean, the morning, you know, in the morning when I would get up and I would realize I needed to talk to my husband about this or that and come out and say, you know, well, we need to talk about our trip or whatever. And he'd say, yeah, we talked about that last night. And then I'd have to go, how am I going to figure out what we decided? Because I don't know whether I'm packing a bikini or a parka. You know, I mean, I just didn't know, you know. And I couldn't stand that anymore. I couldn't stand the lies. I couldn't stand covering it up and lying about it. But what happened? What happened? One morning when I was moaning and groaning in the bed about how I had the stomach flu for the fourth time that week, and I could see my husband in the walk-in closet. You know, this is so sweet. He would bring me a cup of tea every single morning. and it would go cold every single morning next to the bed. And there's a scene from that movie, When a Man Loves a Woman, this exact same scene. But he did it. But one morning I was kind of moaning, and I could see him in the walk-in closet, and the light was on. And he did something he had never done before. I mean, he had never complained about my drinking. And he just turned and looked at me, and he went, "Oh, for God's sake, get out of the bed!" And grabbed his jacket and left. It just stunned me, and I just rolled over and I said in my head or out loud, I just said, "God help me. God help me." And then, that afternoon I happened to have an appointment with my psychiatrist, who I was seeing for depression, because I was drinking massive doses of a depressant every night. And anyway, I had this appointment, and that afternoon, I said to her, "I'm an alcoholic." And she had this huge light bulb go off over her head, and in the sweetest, most loving voice ever, she said, "Well, you'd like to get some help for that, wouldn't you?" And, I burst into tears, because I didn't know what I was doing when I was saying that out loud. I didn't know that I was reaching out for help. I just needed to say it to somebody. The next time I went back, she had done some research, and she took me into the position. She sent me into the direction of going to Ridgeview. So I went to Ridgeview, and while I was there, I was actually locked in Ridgeview for about 5 days, and then I went to the evening program after work, which was really, really good for me, because I didn't know I had a spiritual and emotional sickness. I figured it was physical, and they would tell me what was wrong with me. And I needed that. I needed the knowledge of what was wrong with me. I wanted a doctor to tell me what was wrong with me. And they did. And I can't remember anything about the serotonin or the dopamine or any of that. I get them all confused all the time, But what they did do was they gave me this book. They gave me the big book. They gave me a soft cover. It was a $20,000 pre-print. You'd think they could have given me a hardcover, right? I think maybe I'll let that resentment go at some point, but I'm not quite ready yet. But anyway, they gave me this book, which I still have. It's a third edition. And I was locked in there about the third or the fourth day, and I was reading. And I got to the third step prayer, and I got to the line about release me from the bondage of myself. And sorry, I know y'all don't like to hear this either, but I'd like to know that I didn't do any drugs, and if you do need to hear this. I had a white light experience. That's all I can describe it as. I was struck through with this sensation that, I understand I'm the problem. I can do something about that, and something wants to help me do something about that. Something now has my attention, and I felt as free and as comfortable as I did when I had that very first drink in my dorm room 15 years earlier. It was the same kind of sensation. And I latched on to that, as only the drowning can do, right? And I have one white chip. I got that when I was in Ridgeview. There was a meeting, and we all got... I didn't even know I was in an AA meeting. I was really... I was like, okay, I'll do what you tell me to do. So I picked up the white chip, and then I figured out it was an AA meeting, and that was a good sign to have a white chip. But it is the only one I have, and I'm not saying that to brag, because in all reality, I relapsed every day for 15 years. I just didn't know there was such a thing as a white chip. I woke up every day that I overdid it and said, "I'm not going to do that again," and then I did it again. So, that's what a relapse is. Tell yourself you're not going to do it, then you do it. So, it doesn't matter how many white chips you have. You get it when you get it. But I finally had hope. There was just something about that feeling when I got to that, release me from the bondage of myself. So I got out, and before I got out, I called my husband and I said, "Could you do me a favor? Could you please take all the wine glasses and put them up? Because I think those are going to be a big trigger for me." So he said, "Sure." So I got home, and he wasn't home. But on the counter in the kitchen was this giant mound of wine glass-shaped pieces of newspaper. So that was about as far as he got. That was his idea of putting up the wine glasses, right? And I just had this laugh. I just, and it was that moment that I realized No non-alcoholic person is ever going to be able to help me through this. They do not see it the way I see it. They do not understand it the way I understand it. He wasn't being mean. He just thought that was good enough, you know. You know, and I had 5 days sobriety or something, you know. So, bless his heart. You know, I just, you know, he did the best he could. But that's when I realized no non-alcoholic was ever going to be able to help me. We went out to dinner to the Chili's at Toco Hills, and it was the first time I went out to dinner in sobriety. And I just, you know, I guess I thought if you went out to dinner and you didn't order alcohol that you were a loser or something, you know. I don't know, for me that just made you an adult or something. It just made you cooler than everybody else. So I don't know, I knew I was going to have to try to do this, right? So we go to the Chili's, we walk in, and we go up to the hostess. You know, there's the bar right there. And when you walk in, and the hostess says, it'll be about 5 minutes. I got to tell you, you know, that used to be nirvana to me. And that was, you know, the best words you could say to me at a restaurant was, you have to wait for your table. Would you like to sit in the bar? Yeah, I loved that. I loved waiting for tables in restaurants because I could go in the bar and down a couple. And for some reason, I thought that meant they didn't count. And so when you got to your dinner table, you get down two more, and those were the ones people would be counting or something. I don't know. But I loved it. And so we did. Instead, we sat on those little wooden benches and went right there, you know, sort of like the principal's office or something. And we're sitting there, and I started crying. I mean, it was really that emotional for me. And my husband's like, would you like to go home? You know, and I'm like, no, I got to go to restaurants, you know. Hostess is looking at me like, good Lord, it's 5 minutes. You don't need to cry. You know, and I'm like, I don't know. So we made it through that dinner, you know, and we hadn't even been married a year. We went on an anniversary dinner to an even nicer place, and I didn't drink through that either. And I just slowly began to realize that, you know, you can go out at night when it's dark to a restaurant and not drink alcohol. It'll be okay, you know, and I did. So I started coming to NABBA. I had a job at the time, so I was coming to the 5:45, and I was just really, really angry for the first year. It wasn't angry at being an alcoholic. I was perfectly okay. I got that part of it. It was just, I just had a lot of unresolved anger that just was squirting out in all these different ways. And a lot of it was self-directed, and I it was very hard on myself. But one day I was... And I was just so egomaniacal about this. You know, I really thought I was the smartest person in the room for figuring out that I was an alcoholic. And so I was sitting behind the curtain, and I was going on and on about how, you know, I figured out I was an alcoholic, and I took myself to Ridgeview, and I come to meetings, and I do this, and I'm going to do that. And then, like, right in the middle of that sentence, I realized, wait a minute, don't you remember when your husband yelled at you? And you said, God help me. And then somehow all these pieces started magically falling together, and now you're sitting in an AA meeting? Oh, maybe I haven't done anything. Maybe God did all this. And that's right there in that meeting is when I did my second step. I came to believe that there was a power greater than myself. And I thought it was me. I really thought I had made all these great decisions, but when I really stepped it way back, and I think if you're in this room and you had one of those experiences, if you take yourself all the way back to right when you started the process of getting sober, you're going to see that there was a God moment in there. So that was my second step, and I began to understand what it meant in the big book when it says that deep down inside of every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And I just didn't know that. I didn't know that God had been with me the entire time. And that it was Julie that was keeping him out of the way. That my light was ready to shine, but I would never let it shine because I was always shoving it back down and saying, no, let me take control of this, or better yet, let alcohol take control of this. And I didn't know he was there inside of me, and I didn't know he was inside of you either. I had no idea. And I liken it to Dorothy's ruby slippers. You know, she had them on the whole time. She just didn't have anybody to tell her how to use them. And that's what happened to me. I came to believe that I had God with me all the time, and I needed you guys to show me how to use Him, how to develop a spiritual life, how to make that power work for me. You know, Dorothy, she had to go through all that crap. I had to go through all that stuff before you guys showed me how to make that work inside of me. So, like a lot of people, I found myself, you know, alcohol-free, but still me, you know, which was kind of difficult. And so you guys started giving me tools to use. And you said, use the serenity prayer. And you said, use the third step. Well, I thought the third step was kind of crazy, and I didn't really know anything. I mean, I would read it and read it in the 12. This is the 12 and 12 for those of you. This is like the other white meat. You know, it's like the other book that people don't talk about much, but I love this book. Anyway, the third step is one that is really, really powerful for me. And I will give you a quick story about it. I was using all the tools that you guys were giving me in early sobriety. I was making gratitude lists. I was saying the serenity prayer and all these things. And one day my husband and I went whitewater rafting on the Chattooga with a group of his fraternity brothers. Now, granted, we were in our 30s, so they were no longer fraternity brothers necessarily, but they all acted like that, right? And I really didn't like these people too much, but I was going to go along for the ride. So we went down the river, came back, got our stuff, took our showers, and came. But somewhere between getting our stuff out of the car and the shower, I lost the keys to the car. And now we're in the Nantahala wilderness, right? This is where Eric Rudolph hid from the FBI for years, right? And I'm totally freaking out, like, we'll never get out of here. What am I going to do? And I, you know, just totally made it huger than it ever really needed to be. But mostly I was embarrassed and I felt stupid, and I knew that all these guys that were with us, all they wanted to do was get back to Atlanta as fast as possible and so they could go to Blind Willie's and get drunk. That's all they wanted to do. And now I was responsible for keeping them from doing that. And I was just feeling like it was this big, you know, neon sign to an idiot, you know, all the things that you feel when you do something kind of stupid. But anyway, I kept going into the guide's hut, camping area, and calling AAA and trying to explain to AAA where I was. And it was just getting later and later and colder and colder, and I don't know, I think I thought those guides were going to make us sleep on the ground or something. But I finally went back in one more time to call AAA, and I know, I have a very terse conversation, let's put it that way, and I hang up the phone and I turn around, I'm all haughty, you know, and the guide says, how's it going? And I'm like, well, I just keep saying the serenity prayer and it doesn't seem to be working. And I'm turning around, you know, all sister, you know. And he goes, oh, and I've got my back to him. I'm walking out now, you know. I told him. And he says, well, my friend Bill says if you say it enough, it'll work. And I'm like, I am in the Nantahala wilderness with an alcoholic who's going to save my life right now. And he did. In that, just that moment, it was so beautiful. And I realized, you know what? This isn't important. It's going to work out. And, you know, he was really kind. He asked me, I had like 3 months. He said, you're doing really well for 3 months. And it made me feel like it was okay to, you know, to feel anxious. Anyway, that's my experience, one of my many experiences with the third step. That, you know, if you are confused by this step, you don't need to be. You know, a lot of people, they debate it, oh, your will and your life, your thoughts and your actions. You don't have to do that. It's very clear. The very last paragraph in the 12 and 12 tells you exactly, you can work a third step. You can actually work a third step, and tells you exactly how to do it in the last paragraph. I do highly recommend that you read all of the paragraphs before that, but I am going to read the last paragraph. It says, it is really easy to begin this practice of step 3. In all times of emotional disturbance or indecision, we can pause, ask for quiet, and in the stillness, simply say, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Thy will, not mine, be done. So, I don't know how we got out of there. I think the locksmith came, but obviously he came, because I'm here. And we made it! I got to about a year in sobriety, and I, you know, I'm kind of a goody-two-shoes, if you haven't figured that out yet, but I was kind of an A student, and I was feeling like, you know, you really shouldn't get to a year in sobriety and not have done a fourth step. So somehow, you know, that would be poor student-like of me, you know? But I didn't, I just you know, like it's some of these we balked, and this one was scaring me, and I would come to the 545 and complain and complain and complain about how I couldn't get it done and I couldn't do it. And I had every excuse under the sun. My best one was that I could not make columns in Microsoft Word, so therefore I could not do a four step because it required columns. I rode that one for several months. That was fun. I still can't make columns in Microsoft Word. I don't want to make columns in Microsoft Word. But I had about a year, and the people in 545 got sick of me complaining about it. And this one guy, Donald Siegel, comes up to me after a meeting, and he goes, "Look, just get a piece of paper, write 'God help me' at the top of it, and start writing." Really? That's how you do it? Yeah, that's how you do a four step, right? So my first four step, remember I told you I was kind of angry still. My first four step was a searching and fearless moral inventory of everybody else in my life but me. But it was the best I could do with what I had. I had no clue what my part was in any of it. I really didn't, you know? I really thought absolutely I got where I was on the backs of everybody else's bad behavior. And I believed it. And I was really relieved when I got all that on paper. And then in my fifth step, I forgot to tell you this. The whole point of telling you that whole story about going to the Chili's was that the next day after I cried in Chili's, I shared about it in a meeting, and a woman said to me, she said, "Well, no wonder, honey, you done lost your best friend." And it just really resonated. I was like, yeah, alcohol was my best friend. And I'm crying because I'm sitting in the bench with my best friends in there in the bar. And so I asked her to be my sponsor. And just that moment, and that's, you know, that's kind of how it happens with sponsors sometimes. You just hear somebody say something that you connect with and you like their spirit and you ask them to sponsor you, and they do the best they can with you. And at that moment was also when I thought, you know, I thought that the four hardest words I would ever say were, "I am an alcoholic." But I realized the four hardest words I would ever say are, "Will you help me?" And I know a lot of people in this program have gone back out because they just won't say those four words. But it was hard. But anyway, so I got this sweet lady who was my sponsor. And I finally did this searching and fearless moral inventory of everybody else in my life but me. Which, ironically, I was trying to be a good student, and if you had graded it, it would have been an F for can't follow directions. And, you know, but it was the best I could do. And I went to her apartment, and I just spewed it all out. I mean, I'm spitting and cussing and, you know, blaming and pointing fingers, and this sister-in-law and that sister and this and that. And she listened to it, you know. She kind of, you're sure she wanted to take a shower afterwards, and it was just, ugh. And afterwards, she just smiled and looked at me, I mean, with love, and said, "My, what a sad, angry, lonely little girl you are." Wow. Really? You know, doing the whole Robert De Niro, you know. "You talking to me?" And I really could. I was like, "What?" I mean, I thought, "Were you not listening?" You know, I mean, did you hear how horrible it's been for me? But because I waited a year, and because everything in this program happens the way God wants it to have it, I was able to hear her say. I was able to hear her in the spirit of love that she was saying it. She was saying, "You know, you got a big problem. We need to work on that, because that's what made it so difficult to be me." You know, I was 34 years old in a grown woman's body, and pretending to be in a grown woman's world. But every time you interacted with me, you were dealing with a 4-year-old, and it was, you know, adults. It confuses adults when that happens, you know. And so I'm like, okay, I need to work on this, you know. And so I did. And then I also had a little list of the character defects. Good Lord, time flies. And I got, so, you know, I came the next day to my home group. I went to the 9:30, and I said, "All right, you guys, I have this list of things that I need to change, and I don't know what to do. Do I just stop doing this stuff? Do I just stop doing this? Is that what I do?" And they're all just like nodding their head. You know, I thought they were going to give me some special thing. They're like, "No, you actually have to stop doing this stuff. You know, you have to start behaving better." And that's why we have the 6th and 7th step, you know, to ask God to remove this stuff and let us have experiences on how we can behave differently. And So they did. And these steps, you know, I have to tell you, if you want to remain a victim, please do not take 6 and 7. Because you cannot be a victim and actually do these steps. I mean, you have to own up your own stuff at some point, and that's when this happens. And if you're willing and have the guts to own your stuff, you can shed light on that and you can make it better. They will not go away forever. Trust me, you know, they just won't. But they're going to get better. But you have to recognize they're there, be willing to own them, be willing to sometimes laugh at them, and fix the things. But anyway, 6 and 7. So they said you have to just stop doing these things. All right, well, I'm the kind of person that if I have something in my teeth, I want you to tell me, right? I don't even care if you're a stranger. I just don't want that in my, I don't want other people seeing that, right? This is who I am. But there's some people that, you know, don't want you to tell them that. You know, they're just, that's too personal or whatever. So, you know, like if you ever see me with my tag hanging out, please put it back in. You know, I just, you know, I would not be offended by that. Well, my husband is just the opposite. I mean, he hates it when I nitpick at him and, you know, take lint off of him and stuff and, you know, complain about the combination of things he's going to wear and stuff like that. I remember one day I said, he had quite the outfit going, and I said, are you going to wear that? And he said, yes. And I said, don't you have any self-esteem? He goes, I have self-esteem coming out my butt. And I looked at him, and I said, well, you must if you're going to wear that outside, because I could not imagine wearing what he was wearing outside. Anyway, he did not like to be picked at. So I had just been, and I said, how do you get rid of these character defects, right? So that night, we're eating dinner. And my husband, I look up at my sweet husband, and he has salad dressing right here on his face. And I'm telling you guys, I thought I was going to have a nervous breakdown, but I said, I'm not saying anything about that salad dressing. I am not. I had to go in the laundry room and say the serenity prayer and come back to dinner. But then, and I didn't ever say anything about it. And the next day, I came to the 9:30, and I was so proud of myself. I wanted the gold star for not saying anything about it. And I said, yeah, to this day, I don't know, you know, where that salad dressing went. And this friend of mine goes, it's on the pillowcase. I'm like, oh, God, no, it's on the pillowcase. Throw the pillowcase out! So anyway, little by little, I'm working these steps, you know. And the 12 and 12 says that the process can be unbelievably humiliating. It's because God is showing us how we have been in these situations. And he gave me a couple of doozies. He really did. Because I'm very hard-headed, and I don't know, he has spent a lot of time pointing out my character defects, I can just tell you that, and I thank him for it, but he can really hit me with the hammer. One of them that I will share with you, because it's about living in the moment and trying to understand what to be, and about gratitude. When my kids were little, I decided to stay home from work and stay home with them, and we decided one day that we were going to go up to the McDonald's on Cheshire Bridge and visit, and my husband was going to come and visit the kids during lunch. So we're out in the play pit out front, and they're in the balls and playing around and everything. My son's probably 2. He steps on his little socks. He steps with his little socks on a ketchup packet, of course. That was going to happen, right? And I'm just bitching about it. I'm like, oh, my God, there's ketchup everywhere. You know, I just could not get it off, get away from that. And I'm like, hey, you don't touch me, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then just at that moment, there comes a siren sound. And I don't know if anybody has a toddler boy, but sirens are a big deal to little boys. And so we all like, yo, it's the siren, you know. So I pick up my son, you know, but I'm like this, holding him like this, because I don't want the ketchup on me, right? And I'm like, okay. I'm like, oh, yeah, I heard the siren, yeah. And here it comes down Cheshire Bridge. Turns out it's an ambulance. I'm like, oh, look at the ambulance. Don't touch me, you know. And here it comes right in front of me. And it on the ambulance, on the side, Grady Neonatal Unit. And I got to tell you, I burst into tears because I was complaining about the ketchup on my son's socks. And I turned to my husband, he was in tears. Because we realized at that moment what we had. And that God just hammers me sometimes. Because I am so selfish about things like that. And I'm not telling you that to tell you that God is mean. he could have been more loving to show me that. What a loving gift to give me. But he had to show me hard because I couldn't see it any other way. I just couldn't see it any other way. And I just, you know, he's not mean. He did that because he loved me, you know, and I needed to see it. Another time, you know, these are the character defects that I have, okay? And what does that have to do with alcoholism? Well, if I continue to live like that, I'm going to become so prickly and so uncomfortable with myself. I'm going to have to drink to be able to get through the day. But I have to mitigate these character defects so that I can live in my moments of real of reality and in gratitude. Another one was, you know, I had quite the sailor mouth on me. I told you I was angry, and I finally figured out that if you cuss a lot, it's really about anger. It has nothing to do with actually trying to express yourself. I mean, really, I have a college education. I had to come up with some other words to express myself, but some of mine just never, I just couldn't get past some of them. But so again, my son teaches me a lot. When he was 2.5, I guess, and he was frustrated doing something, and he said, in perfect context, "God damn it." And I'm telling you, you do not know how offensive that word is until it comes out of a two-year-old's mouth. That couldn't, I was like, oh my God, in context. He knew how to use the word. It wasn't like he was running around singing it down the house. You know, I'm like, oh Lord, I got problems. You know, and again, I fell to my knees and I apologized to God because that's pretty offensive. And I thought about all the times that I just spewed that out wherever I was. And I care where, in restaurants, in bars, in churches, and you know, in front of grandmothers and you know, religious people. I didn't care. I have a right to use these words, right? No, I was inflicting I was inflicting myself on people, and there I was inflicting myself on my son. So I've gotten a lot better about it. I'm not perfect, and you know, and I know now, and you will know when I'm furious because not any real words come out. All those good ones come out. But and now when they slip out, I will apologize to my children, and they will say to me, "Mom, it's okay. We go to public school, and we hear more than that every day. You know, worse than that every day." I have to tell you, I have a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old who are sober babies. And there are some people in this room that were here when I was having them, in the process of having them. And, you know, what an incredible gift. You know, I know I wouldn't have children without this program. And they are, you know, just, I don't know, they're gorgeous, fabulous children. Can you say that about your own kids? Too late, just did. So there are some things that you do in sobriety that are God's ways of getting you refocused. In terms of the eighth step, I took that step. I'm not a believer that your fourth step is your eighth step. I don't believe that. But I do think, you know, we need to search ourselves for those people that we keep thinking about. If we're still thinking about somebody, there's probably something that we resent about them, and we need to think about what our part is. And there's always going to be more revealed. We can't remember them all all the time. But I think a lot of us don't want to do the eighth step because we are balking at the ninth step, because the ninth step seems so horrible. And yet I'm going to tell you, the ninth step was really a good thing for me. Do you want to read something off of the ninth? The first sentence of the ninth step says, "Good judgment, a careful sense of time, and courage and prudence. These are the qualities we shall need when we take step 9. I don't know about you, but I don't have those qualities. Never had them, never will have them. So that's why I needed a sponsor. And I highly recommend that you have a sponsor before you do any of your ninth step amends. I have done all the kinds that you can do, face-to-face, telephone. You know, I didn't have to do, thankfully my parents were both still alive when I got sober. I have not had to do any graveside ones. I've sent letters, those kind of things. And I just, I'm very, very grateful for my sponsors through the years who've helped me with those. You know, one day I woke up, and I thought to myself that God had told me to write my sister a letter. And so I sat down and wrote my sister a letter of an apology. This is my sister from hell, right? Now, you know, if you're already calling your sister the sister from hell, maybe you need some help writing a letter to her. But I wrote the letter because God told me to do it in my mind. And I watched the mailman take it away. And then I called my sponsor and I said, guess what I just did? I just wrote Nina a letter and I just watched the mailman take it away. And there was dead silence. And she said, don't ever do that again. I was so proud of myself, you know. No. And sure enough, a week later, I got a letter back from my sister. And the first line was, I no longer associate with evil people. So perhaps I didn't write what I thought I was writing in the letter. You know, maybe I need a little help with that. And I encourage you not to go off on your own. I really encourage you not to do that. Now, 10, 11, and 12, you know, help keep my spiritual condition as strong as it can possibly be. And the 10th step I need to remember is it's not the I'm sorry step, okay? It's really more the restraint of tongue and pen step so that we don't have to say we're sorry. Okay? And I've been told that you get, for every year of sobriety, you get a second of pause. You know, because we're pretty quick on the trigger, most of us, and that's why we get in trouble. And so we get a second of pause for every year of sobriety. And I like that. Because, you know, 18 seconds is a really long time. And you can really keep yourself out of trouble if you really will do that. It's not the I'm sorry step, it's more the, it helps me with my impulsive nature, okay, because I tend to be very impulsive. It teaches me restraint, okay? And I read step 10 out of 12 and 12 every day for weeks before certain people come into my life. You know, if I know I'm going to be meeting with somebody who I really can't handle, I will read this for, and it helps me. I did it back when... the sister from hell was coming for dinner one night. You know, I have to tell you, the program does work because she's now the sister from Houston, so she's getting better. But I read it every night, and she showed up for dinner, and my brother knew what I was doing, and I was not going to say anything. I decided I'm not going to say anything. And it was really interesting because in the past I would be all pissy about that. Like, why can't I talk at dinner? Why can't I get any attention at dinner? You know. But I decided I'm not going to do it because this book has said, look, don't take the bait. Don't take the bait. So I listened, and the wild thing happened. I heard her for the first time. I heard how much pain she was in. I heard how much anguish she had and need for validation from our parents and all the things that we've fought over for years. And I could never have heard that if I had kept trying to get my little 2 cents in. So I highly encourage you to think of the 10th step as more than the I'm sorry step. The 11th step, you know, I'm not a very good meditator, but I do still pray every day to my God and my higher power, and I ask Him to remove my compulsions and cravings for alcohol. And I still thank Him on my knees every night for having done that and for the people in my life and for the things that I did right. And I ask for a little strength to do things better. And the book tells us that if we do that, we will have a solid, foundation for life. And I had a very shaky foundation for life when I came in here. And I know now that if anything tried to shake me from the foundation, that God and some of the people in this room would keep me on board. I know they would. And then I get to live step 12 every day, which is really wonderful. I'm not a perfect person, which is really disconcerting because I was when I came in here. Everybody else was all messed up. But no, you guys gave me back my humanity and my ability to be a human being and to be imperfect. And that's been a wonderful place to be in life. And I was given a gift from God. I was given the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I picked up this kit of spiritual tools that had been laid at my feet. I let you guys show me how to use them. And I try to put them into use as often as possible. I do sponsor other people. I try to carry the message. I do service work. And I love coming to meetings. But most of all, I love the gift that God has given me. And I can't imagine giving it back. And I hope that I was able to share my experience, strength, and hope with you in some way, and that I can't thank you enough for keeping me sober for the day.
Thank you. That was awesome.
First I slipped, And then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something that sets me free. Take me where the promises are.